Due to the graphic nature of this urban legend, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes extremely graphic depictions of human dissection, medical cruelty, body horror, and abuse. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Dissection is a necessary but often unnerving part of studying anatomy. Taking a scalpel to the corpse of a cat, pig, or sheep in high school biology is frightening in and of itself. But all doctors are forced to face the inevitability of their own demise by dissecting a human cadaver. Most medical students struggle with the very notion of having to participate in this particular part of their study. It's hard enough to dissect a stranger. But what if the corpse under your knife is part of your own family? Welcome to Haunted Places, a Parcast original. I'm Greg Polson. Every Thursday, we take you to the scariest, eeriest, most haunted, real places on Earth and share their stories. This episode is part of our Urban Legends Halloween special. Every day for the month of October, we're presenting our spooky spin on an urban legend, then diving into the history of the horror. Like it or not, each terrifying tale contains a grain of truth. You can find episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Haunted Places for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Haunted Places in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. Today, we examine an urban legend that takes the often gross, everyday reality of medical dissections to a dark place, leaving questions about physical fragility, identity, and that eternal question: what becomes of us when we die? The practice of human dissection first became a regular part of Western medical training during the 15th century. When the demand for corpses became too high, a whole industry grew around grave robbing for medical schools. While current science has a system in place to manage both supply and demand, the needs of medical dissection will always have an inescapable darkness. Like the kidney heist, the story of relatives' cadaver dissection deals with the notion that our bodies never truly belong to us. In many parts of the United States, families aren't allowed to take their loved ones' corpses away from hospitals without the assistance of a funeral director who must be paid for their services. The American funeral industry tends to keep the physical process of death, decomposition, and embalming behind closed doors. Your departed loved one descends into the basement of a funeral home and reemerges in full lifelike makeup, perfectly preserved. We don't see the cotton stuffed into orifices to keep their shape, the sponges and swabs that have wiped away dirt and grime and stink. In death, they're reborn, pristine, sanitized, distant. This distance, coupled with very natural discomfort around dismembered human remains, forms the core of relatives' cadaver dissection. The story is a manifestation of two of our deepest insecurities: the handling of our loved ones' remains and our own mortality. Being an only child had its perks. One of these was the ability to use the house when your parents are out of town. It was a perk Vera was all too eager to take advantage of when she needed a quiet space to study. It was especially necessary as she prepared for the biggest hurdle in her med school studies: her first human cadaver dissection. Her apartment was too noisy, and the library was too cluttered with people for her to concentrate. So she texted her parents and asked if she could do some laundry and study at their country house. Their lack of response confused her, until she remembered what day it was. She hadn't always been an only child. For 32 minutes, she had been one of a pair. Her parents had told her that her birthday was always for her, but she knew that wasn't quite true. This day was for her sister, who never quite was. Vera knew how hard this was for them, and she wanted to help out any way she could. Maybe she could do a little cleaning and gardening when she wasn't working. But when she arrived at her parents' house, it was almost spotless. Oh well. She sat up at the kitchen table and began studying. The scratching started slowly. Vera told herself it was some creature stuck in the walls. It wouldn't be the first time. The summer she was 12, a raccoon had gotten trapped in the east wall of her bedroom. Her father had told her to leave the room and taken care of it. She tried to concentrate on the words, but curiosity was getting the better of her. Instead of seeing medical diagrams and charts, her mind conjured images of a small rodent, tinier than the palm of her hand, choking on poisonous pink insulation. The rodent scratched at the walls. It had been separated from its family. Its breath was coming in little pants, its small noises of distress swallowed by the toxic pink clouds. She needed to help it. Vera dropped her highlighter and stood up, following the sound. She trailed her fingers along the wall, pressing her ear against the cold eggshell paint until she finally found it. It was behind the family entertainment center, a wall of book-laden cases and cabinets that loomed over the living room. Luckily, it wasn't a single unit. She would only have to move one bookshelf to free the little guy. She dragged a chair from the kitchen and climbed on top of it. The bookshelf was heavier than she expected. Leveraging her weight, Vera pulled as hard as she could. The chair wobbled underneath her. She steadied herself and took a deep breath. She finally made progress, feeling the enormous weight shift away from the wall. As the corner slid across the floor, it revealed a series of sliding marks beneath it, as if this had been done before, regularly. Vera was puzzled. The unit had been installed when she was 5. They hadn't moved it since then. She had expected to see a plain wall behind it. Instead, there was a door-sized cutout with no visible handle. She climbed off the chair and stepped towards it. She pushed on the wall with trembling fingers. It bent inward, and a cramped hallway stretched out before her, long and dark, with a single door at the far end. She crept forward as quietly as she could. There was a rhythm to the scratching, a pattern growing as she traveled down the corridor. Maybe it wasn't a rodent at all. Vera reached the door. She turned the knob, but it was locked. She twisted as hard as she could, but it wouldn't give. She told herself to be brave and knocked. The scratching stopped. Somewhere, something breathed. Then, the knob turned from the other side. Slowly, it caught, stuck. It was locked from both sides. Vera felt along the doorframe, stretching to the very top. Cold metal met her fingers. She pulled down a small key. Vera unlocked the door, then slowly pushed it open. Then, she stepped into her high school bedroom. This couldn't be real. It had been years since she had lived at home. Her old room was on the other side of the house, converted to a home gym. And yet, it was all here. Teal walls, One Direction posters, a small white daybed pushed against the wall, seashells on the comforter. She turned away from the bed, towards the hidden reading nook she'd built with her father's help. Her chest tightened as she turned the corner. A woman dressed in soft purple was scratching through the wallpaper. Big sheets of it hung, ragged from exposed plaster, like open wounds on the wall. The woman was humming to herself, a song Vera's mother used to sing when Vera was small. Vera cleared her throat. The woman turned. It was her. Same age, same brown eyes, same small nose, same shoulder-length haircut. So much was the same, but the longer she stared, the more differences appeared. Somehow that was worse. Vera had freckles, but her double had none. Her lips were thinner, paler, cracked. Vera was wearing her study wear. Sweatpants, a comfy shirt. Her double was wearing a nightgown. Really, she was swimming in it. Too thin, with bags under her eyes. Her skin was sallow. The other Vera cocked her head, studying her. Vera was frozen, unsure of how to proceed, what to think, or even who she was anymore. The woman laughed softly, and then she lunged. Vera ran, throwing herself through the open door and slamming it behind her. She rushed for the second door, but the hallway seemed to be lengthening as she ran. Her breath came in rough heaves, and her muscles screamed. Finally, she reached the cutout. She threw herself against it and tumbled out into the living room, her face smacking against the hardwood floor. When the world came back into focus, her mother loomed over her. Vera desperately tried to warn her that the woman was coming, but her mother only looked puzzled. She nodded to the wall behind them. The bookshelf was back in place. Vera wondered if it even had moved at all. She tried to tell them more about the replica of her bedroom, about the strange woman who looked just like her, but they wouldn't let her get a single word in as they brushed her hair out of her eyes and fed her soup. They read aloud from her textbooks so she could still get some studying done while she recuperated, but they were very concerned that she was overworking herself. Clearly, med school was giving her stress dreams, but they weren't worth dwelling on for even a second. She needed to drink more water and take more walks. Eventually, her parents wore her down. Vera took the weekend to recover. On Monday, Vera's head ached, but she felt better overall. She was ready to conquer the world of cadaver dissection with her partner, Betty. The pungent odor of formaldehyde coated the walls. Vera covered her mouth and nose with a mask, but the smell still seeped in. Vera pulled the white sheet up, exposing the legs and torso of her corpse to the air. The professor had recommended that they keep the face covered until they felt comfortable with the process. She had been visualizing this for months, but she still hesitated with the scalpel in her hand. She tried to tell herself that this wasn't a she. This was an it. But it had clearly been sick. It was rail thin, her fingernails raw and jagged. She had suffered before she died. Vera didn't want her to suffer again. Betty picked up on Vera's hesitation. She offered to do the first cut. Once they started looking at the body as an object, rather than a person, it would get easier. Vera shook her head. She could do this. Whatever the poor woman had felt, she wasn't a person anymore. It wasn't. She cut a line down the torso. The skin was pliable underneath from all the chemicals. Her stomach churned in sympathy with the deceased. Vera carved two horizontal lines at the top and bottom of her vertical one. She tugged at the skin flaps she'd made, but they wouldn't come free. Betty nodded gently, trying to encourage her. Vera took a deep breath and pulled one more time. The skin came away. Vera and Betty sighed in synchronized relief, then found themselves stifling a giggle. They composed themselves and returned to work. Betty offered to take the first incision on the head. Vera nodded, and they both moved to the front of the table. She gave Betty a nervous smile, counted to three, and then pulled the sheet off. Brown eyes that had lost any trace of life. A small clover-shaped nose. Hair that would have just brushed the tips of the shoulders. For the second time in a handful of days, Vera was staring at a carbon copy of her face. Only now, she knew what she would look like when she died. Her legs gave out. Betty dropped the scalpel as she attempted to catch her. The formaldehyde-coated blade dug into Vera's arm. White-hot pain carried her into darkness. In a moment, Vera learns the truth of the familiar corpse. Now back to the story. Vera woke in the campus infirmary. Dazed, she tried to explain what had happened to her. The strange doppelganger she found concealed in her parents' house. The ensuing attack. Her exhaustion. Rushing to her first human anatomy class, only to find her double on the operating table. They nodded in patronizing there-there understanding, cleaned her surprisingly shallow cut, gave her a clean bill of health, and sent her away. Someone always fainted on the first day, they chuckled. Vera had wanted to become a doctor to help people, to make sense of the world. But none of this made sense. She needed answers, and the only place she'd be able to find them was where it had begun. Her parents weren't expecting her to visit again so soon. They were in the kitchen, eating a leisurely lunch. Steam from their coffees curled in the air, straight out of a Rockwell painting. Vera told them about the dissection. Her mother said it must have been awful. Was she all right? Why hadn't she come home earlier? Did she need to call Dr. Harford? He would surely fit her in. A spark of hope glimmered in Vera's heart. Maybe they didn't know. Maybe this mysterious woman that shared her face had died of natural causes. The body had just ended up in the cadaver lab. It could happen. If she wasn't looking so closely, Vera would have missed it. The slightest uptilt of her mother's mouth. The glint of mischief in her father's eyes. They were sharing a secret, one that they'd kept for far too long. Her father offered to pour her a cup of coffee. Vera turned him down, taking several steps back. Her parents were PTA presidents, peewee soccer coaches. They didn't hide someone behind a wall for years, and they certainly didn't kill anyone. But there had been someone in the walls, someone who wore their daughter's face. And that woman had died shortly after she'd met her. Her double had come back to her, even in death. Vera couldn't risk it. She lied, saying she'd left a textbook here and she just needed to pick it up. Then she'd be out of their hair. Vera had only made it two steps when she felt strong arms wrap around her abdomen. Her mother stood in front of her, eyes hard and jaw tight. She said it wasn't kind of Vera to lie to her parents. Actions had consequences. Vera's heart dropped into her stomach. She fought her father's grip as hard as she could, kicking and screaming. But her father was a strong man, always had been. He threw her into a dining chair and tied her down. He told her to stop fidgeting. She needed to be a grown-up about this. She knew that the scratching in the walls wasn't a raccoon. It never had been. It was always her sister, clawing, fighting, begging on the other side of the wall. Vera begged now, too. She could be good. She wouldn't say anything. Her mother laughed bitterly. It was too late for her. The soup and the tea. If she had been patient, she would have just died of arsenic poisoning. Vera couldn't understand. Why would they do such a thing to their own child? To their own children? Her mother looked at her pityingly. Her sister had been delicate. Too fragile to face the world. If Vera knew, she only would have snuck germs and diseases into her sister's safe, perfect world. They were trying to protect her. But once Vera found out, well, they could not have their secret getting out. It was better to not have children at all. Especially such a nosy child who came over without permission and went places she wasn't allowed. They might have looked the other way. But how were they to know the turnover on corpse donation happened so quickly? They hadn't meant for her sister to end up under her knife. They weren't monsters. If only she'd understood that. Perhaps all this could have been avoided. But she hadn't. So, it wasn't. Her mother told Vera to sit still and not struggle. It would all be over soon. Betty was worried. Vera had missed class twice now after her fall. She wasn't responding to texts or calls. The professor had placed Betty with a new partner, temporarily. They'd be starting from the beginning again. Betty took the lead, cutting into the torso like a pro. She examined all the muscle groups and prepared to move to the head. She had this program in hand. But there was a cut on the arm of the cadaver that looked familiar. She shook it off, telling herself she was projecting. This person was no longer a person. They pulled the sheet away. Vera's face stared back at them. Betty's scalpel dropped. Then, she began to scream. In her book, Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, journalist Mary Roach writes that, "You are a person, and then you cease to be a person, and a cadaver takes your place." This was not always the case. There's a very clear point in history where the dead became something more than objects. Between 226,000 and 335,000 years ago, Homo naledi, a kind of evolutionary bridge between Neanderthals and primitive humans, began intentionally interring their dead in a crypt-like cave formation rather than disposing of them in bone piles. Nomadic Neanderthals are believed to have buried their loved ones with grave markers and flowers, and some of the greatest architectural achievements of the ancient world are tombs. Cultures like ancient Egypt had whole business districts and microeconomies tied to the care and keeping of the dead, from ritualistic mummification to the crafting of extensive models and riches for the deceased to take to the next life. The Vikings would bury entire ships with lost loved ones. But even as these civilizations venerated death, they also sought to prevent it. The study of anatomy has always been complicated by the taboo on corpse handling, and the debate surrounding human dissection in Western medicine dates back to 3 BCE in Greece. Until this point, curious physicians have been relying on paper texts and charts, many of which either didn't account for biological variation or were simply made up. They decided the only way to learn about the human body was to take it apart after death. Human dissection was considered to be heresy by the young Catholic Church, and as Christianity spread, the practice of human dissection dwindled, only re-emerging in European historical records in 1292, when Pope Nicholas II mandated that human dissection was a necessary part of medical study. The cadavers were all executed criminals, but the legal supply didn't match the demand. In 1319, four students in Italy were charged with grave robbing. They had dug up a body and brought it to their professor's house for an impromptu dissection. By the 16th century, grave robbing for medical schools became commonplace, and public dissections were also conducted as a kind of edutainment. In one instance, a group of students stole a body and flayed the skin off it so there would be no way for the relatives to recognize the corpse if they decided to have a night out in the operating theater. These cases fueled cultural anxiety surrounding the practice, and several prominent physicians were said to have murdered people specifically to meet their demand for more subjects. In 1768, a gossip pamphlet reported that English novelist Lawrence Sterne's body was stolen by grave robbers, who then sold it to a university for dissection purposes. One of Sterne's confidants was attending the dissection and recognized his friend's corpse. Scandal rocked Edinburgh, Scotland in 1828, when two so-called resurrection men, William Burke and William Hare, were apprehended after a year-long murder spree that claimed 16 people. Burke and Hare had sold the corpses of their victims to Dr. Robert Knox, a notable anatomist of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. The United Kingdom introduced the Anatomy Act in 1832, which allowed anatomists to collect any unclaimed bodies from workhouses as research specimens, hoping to alleviate the demand that allowed grave robbing to flourish. Acknowledging the darker side of the need for cadavers allowed for more concrete supply systems to be put into place, and the rumors of grave robbing became far less common. However, this did not prevent medical students from encountering surprises on their operating tables. In 1982, a student at the University of Alabama walked into her dissection class to discover that her deceased great-aunt was one of the bodies on the slab. In this particular instance, the aunt had donated her body to science, but the student was still shocked by the improbability of her relative ending up in her own classroom. There's a visceral kind of horror in discovering that a loved one hasn't been laid to rest. We become upset on the deceased relative's behalf, knowing we must speak because they cannot. Ultimately, relatives' cadaver dissection is an urban legend about both the loss of the people we love and the loss of our agency when we die. While many urban legends focus on violence, murders, or near misses, this story's near miss is existential. We all will die, and someone will look down at us the way the story's protagonist does. We all become objects. And that revelation is far scarier than any vanishing hitchhiker. Thanks again for tuning into Haunted Places. We'll be back tomorrow with a new urban legend, and on Thursday with a new haunted place. You can find more episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Haunted Places, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Haunted Places on Spotify, just open the app and type Haunted Places in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. Until tomorrow, don't believe some of the things you hear. Believe all of them. Haunted Places was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Kenny Hobbs. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Haunted Places was written by Lil D. Ritter and Jennifer Richey. I'm Greg Polson.